Hello and welcome to the Horticulture Week podcast, which features horticulture industry issues and personalities every week. I'm Hort Week editor Matthew Appleby, and today I'm with Fargrow Managing Director Richard Hopkins. So welcome, Richard.
Hi there, Matthew.
Good to see you again. Now, we are in the spring in the UK and the gardening season is upon us. So what's the outlook? What's been catching your eye recently that's been going on in the horticulture industry?
Well, it's been a good spring so far, though it's hard to believe looking at the weather out the window at the moment. But a lot of growers seem pretty optimistic and are gearing up for what we hope will be some better weather over the next few weeks, which is really encouraging to see, because last year was a very poor summer. Everyone suffered and there was an extreme lack of consumer confidence. But we're seeing that improve. We look at the stats, we try to see what's going on in the market, and we're optimistic, Matthew.
Excellent. Now, it's an election year, so I know you've been looking at policy asks by some of the industry bodies. So what do you make of all that?
Absolutely, yes. I think I would urge all your listeners who are growers and connected to the industry to look at the election documents which various organisations have put out. What we find is you need to have a consistent message when talking to local MPs or DEFRA or any of the influencers and policymakers. So I've been taking a look at three of them. The HTA have got an election year manifesto out, and so is the Agricultural Industries Confederation. And I chair the crop protection and agronomy sector there, and the NFU, of course, as well. And they're pretty extensive documents, mostly. The HTA have got 10 points that they want to highlight to whatever the new government is. The NFU have got 10 points. The AIC have really focused down and to three points. But there's a big overlap, which I think is important, which is encouraging that there's a big overlap. But there's also a slight difference in emphasis. The key ones that affect Fargrow and a lot of our customers will be on peat and the usage of that and how that is legislated for. Plant health is a real burning issue at the moment, phytosanitary controls. And the use of water is becoming increasingly important and a topic which people are prepared to engage in. And plant protection products, which is a particular interest of Fargrow's and mine, and the difficulties we have in getting good plant protection products onto the market so the growers can do what they need to do. But those documents are all excellent. I urge everyone to go and have a look at those. And make sure that they are speaking to everyone they can about them to get the message across. I think we all suffer in this industry we end up meeting some very good people, excellent people at DEFRA, but it's one of those government departments where people are fairly transitory. They move through, they get promoted, they move on, which is a real shame, because what could be more important than producing food for the country? We have to keep repeating the message and keeping the message simple to get some traction. And so then it actually goes up to the ultimate decision makers, which are at the Cabinet Office, number 10, the Treasury, and get them engaged as well.
Okay, well, let's go through those big issues one by one. First of all, crop protection. There's still no national action plan. So why is this important, do you think?
It is so important, Matt. The national action plan, if anyone's been following it, knows that it's been delayed and delayed and delayed. And the last official notification was it was going to be released at the end of February. Well, we're now at the end of March. Interestingly, DEFRA are still engaged in this process. My understanding was it was in final draft form and was going through the sort of devolved authorities just to get final sign-off. But I understand that there were sort of active conversations in the last week or two where DEFRA acknowledged that the current arrangements are not designed for the British context, and they want to explore the scope for improvements to make regulations more effective. Now, this is the kind of conversation you'd have expected some years ago, immediately post-Brexit, and would have informed the National Action Plan from that point. So it's slightly puzzling that this conversation is happening now, but better now than never. They appear to be really interested in exploring the availability of low-risk pest management, so sort of biopesticides, biocontrols, which again is very encouraging. These are all things which we would have hoped would be in detail in the National Action Plan already, but you know, it remains to be seen. I guess we can't complain that we are actually getting some engagement even at this late stage.
No, that's good stuff. Do you think there's a sort of culture of delay, though, and why do you think that is?
Yeah, it's extraordinary, isn't it? I mean, it's... I have to say, my personal view, sometimes it sort of moves between incompetence and political delays. You know, it's being used for something else. You know, you try and understand the broader narrative of why these documents get delayed for one reason or another. There are also, you know, governments, individual ministers and MPs are under huge pressure from single issue pressure groups, NGOs, and they, you know, they have to have all the answers. You know, pressure groups can present a complaint. They don't have to present a solution. And that, I think, that creates a real challenge for policymakers to navigate their way through that. But there is a fundamental difference, which I would really like to see. Obviously, CRD are the body responsible for, they're the regulator for crop protection products. But I would like them to be an enabler. And by that, to be an enabler to provide UK farmers and growers with the full range of plant protection products that make them economically viable. And that's critical. Everyone talks about sustainability, but you can only be sustainable if you can make a profit. If you can't make a profit, you can't be sustainable. And they should be an enabler to provide that economic stability, which also helps meet the government's food security and environmental objectives. They're not in conflict, those outcomes. But that would require a change of culture at CRD. They're a regulator. They take their job very seriously. They've got some very good people there. But their brief is to be a regulator. And we don't want to deviate away from human safety and environmental safety, but it requires a change of culture which only DEFRA can instruct. I don't know whether that will ever happen, but I'm hopeful. I'm always hopeful now.
Well, maybe with a new government. Next big issue, which is always the biggest issue at Hort Week in recent years, is the peat-free transition. So what's happening there?
Well, Fargrow are working with lots of growers and have been for some years on trialling peat-free alternatives. And it's got a lot higher profile now with the RHS working on their peat-free project, which Fargrow participate in. And it's also finding now that the demand is coming from consumers and retailers, which is, to my mind, where it should be coming from. I would be much more comfortable with that transition being driven by demand rather than by legislation. The objective of the 2026 peat ban realistically is not going to happen because there is no legislative vehicle for that to actually go into. So unless it, after the election, at some point this year, let's assume it's towards the end of the year, unless that becomes the burning issue that the new government wants to push into their first King's speech, it's unlikely to happen. But the momentum is still in that direction. And, you know, we're not dealing with any growers who are ignoring this. They are all taking it seriously. They're all working really hard. And I think we should frame this as an opportunity. And there are challenges. I absolutely accept that. It's not an easy thing, depending on your crop and growing environment and systems. But it is an opportunity to get on the right side of consumer sentiment. And that's critical because obviously all our growers, they're only one step away from retailers. And some of them are retailers themselves. So that's the opportunity they've got. But we're already seeing, you know, it's the total peat usage now is, it's less than 1 million cubic meters, I think the last figure used in horticulture. So it's declining massively, and everyone is focused on responsible sourcing. There needs to be some agreement on how to promote a peat-free plant, in my view. There's lots of different logos and things which are being used, but a bit of consistency would help consumer understanding. And looking for responsible sourcing and championing that, of what this looks like in the future. A lot of the focus is how do we resolve this issue right now, because there's this deadline. But we also need to look what happens over the next 5, 10, 15 years and what materials can be available then. But there are two issues here, aren't there? There's the technical issue on actually is it possible to do and is it economically viable to do? But there's also this cliff edge risk, which hasn't gone away, even though the deadline may not be imposed from legislation. The cliff edge is, if there is a cliff edge, then retailers, if they're only allowed to sell plants grown in peat free, that will be a problem because there aren't many European growers who are moving over to that. So there would be a shortage of ornamental plants in garden centres. We can't scale up that quickly to fulfil that demand. And of course, retailers need the plants on the shelves. They've got their own business dynamics. They've got to have that constant throughput. The problem then is you have growers abroad who are able to grow in peat very efficiently. They've been doing it for years, inexpensively, and therefore they're then competing with a higher cost product in the UK. So we'd end up without a level playing field, which would be very unfair. And that's something which, in the conversations I've had with DEFRA, they seem to be struggling to understand what that risk actually is to the UK industry.
No, I see. So do you think it matters? How much does it matter if it becomes law or not? Do you think the industry will just do it anyway?
I think the UK industry will do it anyway. There will be a few outliers, of course there will. But everyone seems to be moving in that direction. And you know, it gains momentum as other people are able to produce case studies and explain how they've done it and what they've done, and that it's not compromising their business by doing it. I think most growers want to do that, because they want to do the right thing and they also want to be seen to be doing the right thing.
Next big issue, target border operating model, plant imports, and that's all up in the air. And so what do you think of that? Are you for or against the changes?
I think I'm against the changes. But being very specific, this is plants for planting, which is where the big challenge is. Having border control posts makes sense for some things coming into the country for phytosanitary inspections, I'm quite sure. But plants for planting are very fragile, and there are often multiple loads, groupage loads on lorries. And again, it's one of these elements where nobody is saying there shouldn't be inspections. Everyone wants to make sure that plants coming into the country are healthy and are not likely to introduce pests and diseases into the wider landscape. But I think the approach that's being taken actually probably won't achieve that. So if they're going to a grower, their plants are planting, the ambition that is 100% inspection rate, but that's actually not strictly true. What they mean is they want to inspect 100% of the lorries carrying plants are planting, which means they'll unload those lorries, and they could, as I said, they could be groupage loads, and then they will inspect some of the plants on that. And I imagine they'll be working to a pretty strict timetable. You know, there's going to be a lot of trucks coming through these control posts. And then you've got this other issue where if plants did have some pest or disease, then it's you're unloading and inspecting these in one location. And then every truck that comes through after that is potentially exposed to those pests and diseases. I mean, these are ultimately could be infection points, not inspection points. So that whole quarantine element of it and the phytosanitary security is completely inimical to what they're actually doing or the methodology that the approach they're taking. It would make far more sense to use the existing method where rather than the border control points, we use the place of destination, and the animal and plant health inspections take place there. And I think most growers would be in support of that. And there's one final thing, which is just makes no sense at all to me, is that, as I said, that if their plants are planting going to a grower, the ambition is 100% inspection. If their plants going directly from a grower on the continent to a retailer, they're only likely to inspect 30%. So plants going into an environment where you've skilled agronomists and skilled growers who, even if something were missed, they would spot it and would be able to deal with it or you know, take the appropriate action. notification or whatever that may be, plants going into a retailer who may just be unloaded, stuck on shelves, and actually could be out the door before anyone recognizes as a problem, have a much lower threshold of inspection, which again makes no sense at all. And actually that potentially imperils the industry, because these pests and diseases could be introduced, which could affect growers, and we might end up with quarantine areas. Who knows? It just seems to be very poorly thought out, Matt, I think.
Not another area where there's still lots of questions. The fourth thing you mentioned earlier on was, or fourth issue was water. I mean, have you got much to say on that one? What do you think can be, done with that? We've got sort of feast or famine, drought or deluge at the moment.
Haven't we? I was looking at the figures fairly recently, and the sort of the average rainfall over the last 20 or so years hasn't actually changed that much. But as we think we all recognise, it's coming down in feast or famine, as you say. We get sort of constant rain or no rain at all. And talking to growers, they need larger reservoirs. It's not because of the lack of water, but you can no longer use your reservoir in the expectation that it'll rain again in a couple of weeks' time and start to top it up, because it might not. And when it does rain, your reservoirs aren't big enough to capture all the water that's there. So I think it's an important point that needs to be made to legislators, that these reservoirs are, there is no downside to them fundamentally. I mean, it's making sure that growers and farmers are not using water for which would be used in towns and cities, potable water that has been treated. That's a ridiculously expensive way of doing things. But if growers are left with no option, then they have to go down that route. So I think we need to recognise there's competition for water. Obviously, there's been very few reservoirs built in this country over the last probably 30 or 40 years, maybe longer than that. There's a big one going in fairly near us in near Portsmouth. But I think it's another 2 or 3 years before that's fully commissioned. So it's a relatively inexpensive thing for the government to go, yes, we need to do this. We need to encourage farmers and growers to do that. And on a broader scale, when we're looking at food production, at the moment, water is not priced in to food production. So when you're buying your green beans from Kenya, effectively, they're exporting their water to you. And when you're buying your oranges and almonds from California, they're exporting their water to you. And that's not priced in. And we have seen in parts of Almeria and in Spain, there are parts which are no longer being cultivated because there isn't enough water for the local villages. And so in Spain, they're able to produce strawberries cheaper than they're produced here, but they're not actually factoring in the cost of the water. And I think we, as a country, we should recognise that. I think consumers should recognise that. And I think in Britain, the whole of Britain, it actually gives us a competitive advantage. Because I think if climate change is going to do anything here, it's going to become warmer and wetter. We will have dry spells, but there will be as the climate gets warmer, you end up with more rain because it holds more moisture. So we should use that to our advantage in food production as well as the horticultural production as well.
Well, we've covered lots of big issues there with Richard Hopkins from Fargrow, and we've got plenty more to talk about. So I'm going to invite Richard back to discuss some more horticulture issues very soon. And we're going to talk about drones, sustainability, fairness in the supply chain, business changes, and last year's robotics conference at Plumpton College. But for the moment, thank you very much to Richard from Fargrow, and I'm Matt Appleby from Horticulture Week. And make sure you never miss a Hort Week podcast. Subscribe to or follow Horticulture Week podcasts via Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or Google Podcasts, or your preferred podcast platform. And once again, thank you. Until next time.